Hello, I'm Todd Steed, and this is Raised in Knoxville.
Well, I had a good time in Bristol, but I had to get moving along. Had a whole lot of places I wanted to see.
And what, pray tell, as my grandmother used to say, is raised in Knoxville? Well, I can tell you what it isn't. George Gershwin, clam chowder, beach music, mangoes, Otis Redding, Mount Rushmore, Carole King, Miles Davis, and the Grand Canyon. Those are all great things, except perhaps clam chowder in the wrong hands. But they most certainly were not created or raised in East Tennessee. Country music, on the other hand.
Again, back to the seasons of my youth. I recall a box of rags that someone gave
us. And love
us.
Makes us all a little crazy sometimes, but I'd rather be crazy than out of her mind.
Raised in Knoxville, made possible by a generous grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and inspired by the new Ken Burns film, Country Music, we'll examine the history of country music in East Tennessee. We'll talk to historians, musicians, writers, and anybody we happen to run into along the way. At one point, we'll also have a listen to two brand new songs commissioned specifically for WUOT in this project. But first, I have to make a confession. I have never been to Bristol, Tennessee, or across the street to Bristol, Virginia. Because country music's Big Bang allegedly took place there, I figured a trip was in order. So, my car is loaded up with Carter family and corn dogs. Let's go find that Big Bang. As the crow flies, Bristol is about 113 miles from Circle Park here in Knoxville. But I'm not a crow, and I had to stop along the way to throw out corn dogs and grab a cold Mountain Dew, which, by the way, was created by two Knoxville brothers as a mixer for their whiskey. I drank my Mountain Dew straight, I'll have you know. One of the things I love about Bristol is that it's not within eyesight of Interstate 81, or any interstate. You have to want to get there enough to drive those few extra miles. The other thing I love about Bristol is the birthplace of Country Music Museum. An entire two-floor museum that celebrates what amounts to basically a few days of recording sessions is a beautiful, beautiful thing, especially when those recordings change the course of American music. After getting completely soaked up in every fascinating aspect of the Bristol sessions, I sat down with head curator Renee Rogers and asked her how this museum came to be.
So the museum came about through a partnership of people who just really cared about the history of what happened here and who knew that history really well. So it was people who were interested, amateurs, it was musicians, it was the cities themselves, and then that group and other sort of parties within it, like who some of them went and talked to their legislators and got the designation of the birthplace of country music for Bristol with both state legislators. And then it went to the U.S. Congress and was given the designation by U.S. Congress in 1998. So there was all this stuff that was happening to sort of recognize that history before the museum was even sort of a twinkle in someone's eye at that point. And the group came together and they were working on performances, sort of educational stuff, and then came together with the idea that having a cultural institution of some sort that told that story and that shared that history and that really became sort of a gathering place for the stories of the music of our region was an important project. But it took probably about 10 to 15 years to raise the money for the plans, for it all to come to the actual fruition when it opened in 2014. The grand opening weekend was pretty amazing, because we'd been working for 2-3 years on the exhibits and thinking about them and imagining what they would be like, and then I actually have a museum that was physically here with that actual, all the stuff we'd been thinking about was a reality. I mean, for those of us who were on the content team, it was a very emotional experience. And it was a wonderful, we had a three days of celebration for the grand opening. So we had obviously loads of people from the local area who came, but also legislators from both Tennessee and Virginia. Our Smithsonian affiliate liaison, because we're a Smithsonian affiliated museum, came for it. We had family members here from the Bristol Sessions, so Bristol Sessions descendants. We had Georgia Warren, who was the last surviving Bristol Sessions musician. She came to the 1927 Bristol Sessions with her father's congregational choir. She was 12 years old at the time. She was in her late 90s when we opened. That was very exciting for us. She was one of the people who did the ribbon cutting, because that was pretty special. People from all over. I mean, we had some people who were passing through and heard about it on the news and stopped in. We had people from further afield. Like I remember Charlene, one of my colleagues, talking to someone from D.C. who had just stopped in because they liked this kind of music and they'd seen it advertised somewhere, and they were on a road trip somewhere else and had the best weekend they said they'd ever had just by coming. And we also had a lot of musicians. We had Dr. Ralph Stanley performing. We had Carlene Carter. Jim Lauderdale, all sorts of really wonderful live music. It was also the same weekend we did a special Song of the Mountains at the Paramount Theater, which is just on across the line in the Bristol, Tennessee, with Martina McBride. So there was a whole host of people that were here just from all over the place.
When I talked to Jack Neely and Brad Reeves, they both told me there were already country music recording sessions going on around the South before the Bristol Sessions. I was curious then, why does Bristol get to call itself the birthplace of country music, other than they got permission from the United States government?
We're called the Birthplace of Country Music Museum, and that is focused in on the 1927 Bristol Sessions and the impact that those particular recording sessions had. But we very much acknowledge that we are part of a much larger context and a much wider story. You know, we do talk about the fact that there was quite a few early recording sessions of hillbilly music that happened before 1927, and in the section of the museum that looks like a train station, we sort of used our arrivals board as a way to sort of convey that information and talk about those earlier recordings. So we know that the story of the creation of this music is bigger than just those recording sessions, but we also know how significant those recording sessions are and the impact that they and that earlier music had, and that's the story we're trying to tell. So moving beyond that one moment that sort of gave us the designation, the birthplace of country music, to look at what came before and what came after, and the other elements of the story that played into the success of these recordings, the changes in technology that were happening, you know, the growth in radio at this time, so the distribution of the music is much wider. There's so many parts of the story that are more than just about the actual recordings themselves.
The museum is really interactive in a way that's cool for kids. Actually, I found it kind of cool for adults, and I will speak for all adults here. And I love all of the classic instruments from the era. And I kind of wondered, when the museum opened, did people just flock to it saying, here, take my 1924 Martin guitar?
Yeah, so, you know, the museum is definitely very interactive, experiential type of museum. So it's not object heavy, but we do have some really interesting objects. And like you said, people who come to us who have very personal stories to tell and are sharing those with us. You know, we do have a Western Electric microphone, which was the kind of electric microphone that was used at the 1927 Bristol Sessions. We have several instruments that are representative of those instruments. You don't actually find many of those instruments still out there existing, because obviously at the time they didn't necessarily know they were making history, but they were also using instruments that they had bought at Sears and Roebuck or had been passed down through their family, and they're not necessarily around, or they're still with the family, which I think is an important thing, is that they're still with the family. But certainly with some of the Bristol Sessions descendants, they've given us some really interesting objects and photographs in particular from their 1927 Bristol Sessions ancestors. So we've had things from Georgia Warren's family, from Alfred Carnes's family, from Ernest Phipps's family, and a few others. You know, we're very fortunate that we have very good relationship with most of the descendants that we know from all those families, the ones that we know we have established good relationships with, they've shared oral histories with us. That's another element that we're getting from these families that we wouldn't get anywhere else, is actual memories of their grandfathers or their uncles or their fathers who were part of this music. And also a lot of records. We have a lot of people donating 78 records. We have a lot of playback and recording, you know, cylinder recording or phonograph machines, several of those. We're very fortunate. Again, there's a collector just down the road, about 15 minutes, who that's all he cares about is phonographs and music-making equipment, and he shared so much of his knowledge with us. And, you know, this area is also filled with luthiers, and so sometimes we get some interesting loans and things given to us from people who have made instruments too, which is another pretty important part of the story of the music of this area.
Earlier, I made the painful confession that I had never been to Bristol before in my entire life. Well, let me make a less painful confession. Earlier this summer, I got the opportunity to interview Ken Burns about this country music film. There was a question I asked that he really liked. The end result of that was he said, "Hey, send this guy the entire documentary. Send this guy the whole film." Now, I thought, okay, that's nice of him to say that, but he won't send it. Well, he did send it, and I've watched it. And let me just tell you this, once you've watched the episode on Bristol, I can't imagine if you're anywhere near Bristol that you won't want to go visit the Birthplace of Country Music Museum. I just imagine people are going to flock to it after this documentary comes out.
Oh, for sure. I mean, obviously we're very hopeful that that will happen, because we know that Ken Burns' documentaries have that impact on so many of the things that he's focused on. So yes, we are anticipating that, and you know, we work very hard at the museum. You know, we know that our part of the story, that really important moment in early commercial country music recording history, happened here. And it, like you said, it is a crucial part of that story. So I think anyone who is interested in the history who hasn't been here before will want to. But I think also for people who don't know much about the history at all, it's an interesting story in and of itself. It's a very personal story in some ways, because so many of those musicians were family bands, or like I said, a congregational choir. That's interesting in and of itself, that it wasn't all professional musicians that made this impact. And you know, we worked really hard at the museum to not only tell that story, but to also provide a huge amount of programming and educational content that can draw people in on other strands. You know, we do a lot of public programming, film screenings, lectures, music performances. We have our radio station. Not many museums have a live working radio station as part of their actual exhibits, where you can see the DJs at work while you're in the museum. And we try really hard to keep people interested in those stories by talking about some of the befores and afters and the influences and the impacts within those venues of programming. And also, you know, we have a special exhibits gallery downstairs. So there's obviously people who think to themselves, "I'm not interested in country music at all." And we try and provide them with something too, that, because we know that once someone walks through our doors, they're going to get interested. And even if they think that they're not, the story is interesting enough, and there's so many ways to enter that story that I think it's going to bring a whole lot of new visitors through our doors.
There's really no question that the music of the Bristol Sessions is important and that it's historic. I mean, anytime you have the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers recording in the United States, it's historic. But how is the music? For me, I have to say, a lot of this music, even though it's maybe crudely recorded and it's not extremely polished, a lot of this music is fantastic.
Once I had a sweetheart, a sweetheart brave and true. His hair was dark and curly, his loving eyes. He told me that he and he often proved it so. And he often come to see me when the evening sun was low.
Jimmy Rogers, the soldier's sweetheart.
Yeah, and it's a real diversity of music. I mean, people think of country music, and especially if you don't know the history, you think of it in a very specific way. But you listen to the 1927 Bristol Sessions, and you've got some blues in there, you've got gospel and sacred music, you've got sort of story songs where they're telling a story, like Wreck of the Old Virginian or old-time corn shucking, sort of humor and things that people don't expect, and it's a very different sound and very distinctive. So yeah, I mean, the music itself is interesting and very good. You know, that's one of the things that our visitors really love, is that we have that section of the museum where you can dive into a clip of each and every song that was released from the Bristol Sessions recordings, and you can see what the lyrics say, and you can learn when it was recorded and who recorded it, and sort of the story behind that artist, because the history of the songs too. You know, some of these songs have been around for such a long time. They're based on these old ballads that came across from Ireland, Scotland, England. It's fascinating.
You have to imagine that Renee Rogers has listened to this music probably more than just about anybody. I wonder if she had any favorites, any particular gems that stood out from the Bristol Sessions.
You know, I really love The Longest Train I Ever Saw, which is also In the Pines, Where Did You Sleep Last Night? Mostly because that's one of the ones that I hear all the time redone by people. And there's so many interesting versions beyond the Bristol Sessions version. I love that one. I love Single Girl, Married Girl, because it makes me laugh a little bit. You know, it's a hard truth in some ways, but it's also quite funny when you think about the way the contrasts are done. And I love Bury Me Under the Weeping Willow, just because it's just a wonderful, lovely song. I think, you know, some of the songs by Alfred Carnes are ones that aren't necessarily as well known by people. And I think it's because I love his voice. He has this wonderful, deep voice that just comes across. So I think, yeah. And I like the harmonica solos, too. So I like L. Watson, Henry Whitter, some of the harmonica music.
As it turns out, Renee Rogers was born in Bristol. I wanted to know exactly what circuitous path took her to the Bristol Sessions, something in her own backyard that she probably didn't grow up with.
You know, I grew up here, went to high school here, and I was the typical teenager, not interested in that kind of thing and very dramatic about everything. So when I went off to college, I was like, I'm never coming back here ever. There's nothing in Bristol. Very typical. And then I went to college, again, pretty typical. But after college, I got a Rotary Ambassadorial Scholarship to England. And part of that ambassadorial scholarship, one of the requirements is that when you are in your host country, you give talks to Rotary clubs about where you come from and the place that you live. And so that's when I started to learn more about the country music history of my town, is because I had to. But then I was like, wow, how did I not know this? How did I not understand that this story was so interesting? And so having that opportunity to share the story that year is what got me interested. And, you know, then I started, I was interested in country music before that, but I didn't know the history. Yeah, it was probably that moment. And then I was in England for another 18 years, so I didn't really think much about it, but I would tell people about my hometown and why it was important. And then I moved back here right around when the museum was starting to get off the ground, and I had a background in interpretation and heritage, and came on board on the content side, and now this content is my life, pretty much. You know, I loved Shania Twain, you know, that sort of girl power type country music. I still love Shania Twain. I loved that. I liked I liked Willie Nelson, so, you know, that's got street cred.
That you'll own up to those.
Yeah, but, you know, I listened to a lot of contemporary country music, and part of that was because when I was in college, I worked down at Tennessee Eastman in Kingsport for the summer, and the part of the factory that I worked in, that's what was on the radio 24/7 while I was there, and it was either You Grow to Love It or You Go Nuts. And I hadn't listened to country music before that, and I actually grew to love it. So all through college after that, the last 2 years of college, because that was my sophomore year, that's the kind of music I listened to. That's the CDs I bought. And now I'm into the old, early hillbilly stuff, so.
Fun elements, but what's the funnest thing about what you get to do?
I think it's partly seeing people's reaction to the museum, because like I said, you know, for us when it opened, there were emotional reactions, but I have seen other people have an emotional reaction to this museum, and not just people who have like a family connection, people who are just being touched by the story or the music or the way that what we have done has found a way to really touch them and have an impact. That's probably the most gratifying part. I think the fun part, though, is, you know, finding ways to engage people in it, you know, thinking up those programs that are interesting. Like a couple of years ago, we had a Luthiers special exhibit, and then we invited three bands that were made up of, some members were Luthiers, to do a Breaking Up Christmas concert. And we had people flat-footing down on the stage in the performance theater while they were playing. You know, so finding those ways, and we had a square dance last weekend. We had a whole room full of people dancing down in our special exhibits gallery while it was empty. Those moments when you get someone to connect who might not have walked through our doors that's fun for me. I've talked about how the museum tells stories beyond that moment in time, those 2 weeks in 1927. And one of the interesting parts of the museum that, again, is probably one of my favorite parts is the area where we do have the instruments. Because I think that's another thing, is talking about the origins of some of the instruments that people imagine, they think of as Appalachian instruments, the guitar, the banjo, the fiddle. Talking about the origins of those instruments and that long history and how they came here is an interesting part of the story too. You know, the banjo is an African instrument, the guitar is Spanish, the fiddle is, and the violin are Italian. Just sort of throwing people's assumptions on the edge with some of the things that we do in the exhibit. I mean, and that's the kind of thing you'll see in any museum that focuses in on musical instruments, they'll have those stories, but a lot of people come here with assumptions, and I'm sure I had those assumptions before I learned more years ago myself about, oh, that's an Appalachian instrument, it originated here, because I see it in every country and bluegrass band. So I like that, and I think the other thing that goes back to something you said earlier about what Ken Burns has done with that documentary is I'm excited about the introduction that's going to give people to our history, but the fact that it's going to get people to just appreciate the talent and the vision of the musicians who were here and the ones who have come after the 1927 Bristol Citizens. And we're just so grateful that we're part of that story. So happy that he looked to Bristol as an important part of that story, because now other people will understand that importance too.
After I finished interviewing Renee Rogers, I walked downstairs and decided to take another look around the museum, and I heard all of these fiddles playing in a room, and I walked into it, and there was an older woman teaching a bunch of young children how to play country music on the fiddle. This museum gets it. The next morning, I woke up and had a really unhealthy breakfast, but it was fabulous. And then I drove to the Museum of Appalachia to talk to Bradley Reeves. So stay tuned for that conversation on the Raised in Knoxville podcast, which is a production of WUOT. I'm Todd Steed. Thanks for listening. On to seek him another.
weeping willow tree.